Hello, my name is Bruder Stapleton. I chair the Child Health Advisory Council that's connected with Career Physician. We are a group of former and mostly current leaders in child health and academic pediatrics who are committed to helping the next generation of leaders. As a group, we try to contribute leadership information and resources for leaders in the field of pediatrics and child health. Today, we have a very interesting and important conversation about how to help develop the career of physician scientist. Our moderator is Dr. Arne Strauss. Co-leading the discussion today is Dr. Catherine Edwards. We're also joined by Drs. Brent Polk, Marva Moxie-Mibbs, John Frohna, Richard Reddy, Richard Sugarman, and Danielle LaRocca-Arena. Dr. Strauss, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Stapleton, and I'm delighted to moderate this first session, which is entitled Recruitment and Career Development of Physician Scientists. Obviously, this is a critical issue for all of us as leaders and the way that we create a legacy and hopefully improve the future for children. I would say a force that's desperately needed in the current environment. So we have three questions that we wanted to address related to this. And the first has to do with describing the key elements and environment for recruitment and development of clinical investigators. Dr. Edwards, currently Emeritus Professor of Infectious Disease and Pediatrics at Vanderbilt and a former esteemed colleague whose expertise in this area is dramatic, and who is a member of the National Academy of Medicine.
First of all, I'm really happy to be here to talk today about this. I think this is really important. I think it's probably important also for you to have a little bit of understanding of sort of what I did in terms of clinical investigation and some of the perspectives that I have. And I think that they're both in terms of developing the physician and supporting the physician scientist, but then also in thinking about how you might recruit physician scientists as they come. So when I came to Vanderbilt in 1980, I was a pediatric infectious disease person and began to work within a framework that was already established of an NIH-funded network. But within that network, I began to develop my own niche, primarily with bacterial vaccines. So I began to develop interactions with pharma to decide and study on vaccines in terms of pharmaceutical vaccines, but that also within this network of NIH that had established a number of studies and sort of an infrastructure as well. And over time, then I extended these networks to look at surveillance networks and CDC and look at safety. And so I'll kind of tie some of that in, but I think it really tries to address how you can be an investigator, what you need to do that, what you need to do for industry-funded studies, what you need to do for NIH or government studies. So the first slide. So I think that one of the things that some of us clinical investigators sort of worry about is that it seems like that the people that do bench research, it's pretty clear what's needed there. You certainly need a bench and you need a number of other resources. But I think that it's really important to understand what a clinical investigator needs. And fortunately, in many medical centers now, these are more efficiently organized. First of all, I think you need to have some support for the investigator and make sure that they have some beginning startup funds. And certainly when I say sometimes this doesn't happen, it's certainly not in any relationship to Arne, because when Arne was my chair, I felt like I was amazingly supported. So I think, first of all, you have to have a site to do your research, and that for me, was examination rooms that were pediatric friendly. You need some equipment to draw blood. You need some laboratory supplies and materials. And you also need storage areas for your study materials. And you're going to need storage areas for your medications. And most of the time, those are managed by an institutional pharmacy, but not always. And those have to be time controlled and temperature controlled. So really a very rich study site that has these resources. In addition, in order for you to do clinical research, you have to have very specific training. You have to have completion of documentation of training, which is called a CITI program, which goes over a number of aspects of clinical trials. You have to take a test and you have to be signed off in that. And so that's something that is also very important. And then you need to have adherence to the standards of the trials. For most of industry-funded studies, those will be attested for by a clinical research organization, but for NIH, that will be tested often by their people. And at any time, any of these things can be audited by the FDA, and certainly we've had FDA audits to make sure that you're adhering to all of these standards. You need research support in terms of IRB. You need to have an IRB that's very efficient, that's very knowledgeable, that understands children's studies, that understands that not only do you have to have consent forms, but you have to have assent forms. And also you need to be really well-versed in the regulations. You also need to have trained research nurses. And the research nurses are different than the clinical nurses. They also have to be trained and certified. They also have to be available and they have to be able to do the tasks that they're being asked to do. And you also have to have a salary structure so that they're being compensated for what they're doing. And sometimes that can be difficult because the inpatient ICU nurses may think that they should get more money and the clinic research nurses. So some of those issues are all HR issues, but they can be problematic. Also, you need to have some research institute support. That can be assistance with IRB processes, with templates, and these all fall into the next, which is the toolbox resources. And these are templates, sample forms for consents, guidelines, informational material, and often a clinical trials office can be very helpful in that regard. And then finally, you have to have regulatory compliance. You have to understand the person who's in charge, the PI of the study, is responsible to adhere to all of these regulations. And certainly, if you do not, your study can be closed. And obviously, that would be a very bad thing. So a number of those resources need to exist. Now, fortunately, a number of places, a number of institutions have infrastructure, and this is often supported by the CTSA grants, which are NIH-funded grants for clinical and translational research. And I'm just going to give you a couple examples at Vanderbilt, what we do, but certainly many of the other medical centers have wonderful programs and wonderful resources to do this as well. Some of the smaller programs may not, and some of the things that you may want to do if you have a smaller program would be to link to other programs that are larger in that regard. So the Vanderbilt Institute is dedicated to helping people with clinical research. They have operational infrastructure, resources, and it's been in existence for about a decade. So a lot of these issues are pretty well managed. There's a lot of resources and education and training. And the Vanderbilt CTSA also functions to be a CTSA for the university, but also for Meharry Medical College. And so it sort of speeds the transitions in all of these as well. And then the next slide goes over as if you have a freestanding children's hospital, you may have an NIH-funded CRC or clinical research center within it. At Vanderbilt, we have a Clinical Research Center that for inpatients, and is which is mostly used by the internists, but some of the patients are pediatric. But in our pediatric outpatient area, we have a large outpatient tower where there are outpatient beds and pediatric equipment and a large room to talk with as well. So I think that when you are going to, when you have young people that are clinical investigators, you need to have these resources, and you also have to have someone who's skilled in this so that you can teach the young people how to do this and work together in some of these things. So I'll close there, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions that you may have about this or about other issues regarding the actual structure of how this is done.
And I would emphasize that this kind of support is not cheap, and it requires maintenance and attention by the leadership, whether that's the chair or division directors.
Kathy, great to see you, and thanks for doing this today. A couple of questions. One is, if we're recruiting a clinical investigator, what kind of, let's assume we've got the infrastructure that you described, what kind of resources should we be thinking about in that recruitment package? I know I'm going to ask Arnie the same thing for the laboratory-based physician scientist.
Well, I guess in terms of the amount, I've not been a chair, nor have I been a division leader. So, you know, I've never had to make these say how much this is going to be, but I would tend to say that it would need to be, I would say, at least 100,000 in terms of the amounts of ability to do these things. I think it depends a little bit upon the infrastructure that exists. And I also think that if you're recruiting young people, that if you have let me give you an example. Let's say that someone is coming into Peds ID, who's a researcher who looks at vaccines, and they come into my group. Obviously, there's a lot of those things that would already be existing, and I would be giving, you know, many of those resources as well. If that doesn't exist, then I think that's more problematic, and you're going to need to get more money. And you, what you may want to do also is, let's say that you're bringing in a very good clinical researcher in GI, but you don't really have a big infrastructure in clinical research in GI. So I think if you would say, well, you know, maybe Kathy could help with this group and that sort of thing. So I think you kind of need to bring new people and link them in. And we'll talk about that a little bit in the advisory group. And so I think and I also think that there does need to be a respect from the institution, you know, from the chair. You know, I'm at an ID meeting now, and I'm, you know, hearing some of my clinical research colleagues that feel they perhaps are not as highly esteemed as the bench researchers. So I think that also is important. I think we sometimes can feel that those sorts of things. And so I think that your enthusiasm, your respect for the people you bring in is reflected in the startup package that you give them, and also in the support that you give them. But again, I think the actual financial amounts I would be less comfortable in saying, but I think I would be much more comfortable in telling you what you would need for actually the conduct of the studies.
I would just mention, I think it's much more than that. It's salary support for 3 years. It's a researcher's guarantee. It's the dollar figure. So in my view, it's on the order of $1 million for a 3-year startup package.
Can I ask if you could add time? We think for bench scientists and translational, 75 to 80% of their initial 3 years devoted. How should we think about this from a clinical investigator standpoint?
I think you should
say exactly the same way as Kathy just said. Absolutely, yes.
Exactly.
And that's a mistake that I made, and I'm sure a few of the people watching have also made. It has to be a similar degree of respect. Marva?
Thank you for that talk. So my question, and maybe this is not a fair question for you, a lot of focus was on places that have like a CTSA, et cetera, but obviously not all places have that. What advice would you give a young person who's looking at a place that may not have that? If they want to do clinical research, do they need to look elsewhere? Are they limited in terms of the places that they would consider going?
Well, when I came to Vanderbilt over 40 years ago, we had none of this. So obviously I managed and, continued to do things. So no, I don't think you have to have those things. I think you have to have the ability to have nursing, to have space, to have have an IRB, have a receptive IRB, have, I think you have to have patient, you have to be able to recruit the patient somewhere. And, one of the very exciting things when I first came was that I recruited the patients out in the practices. And so that worked really, really well as well. So I think you have to have all of the parts to do that, but I don't think you have to have a fancy, system to do that. I do think you need I think you need to be really efficient and hardworking. And I think that you need to have some people that are there to help you and cheer you on. But I think that you don't have to have those things. But the other thing is that I think you can also have champions. So, some of my young people that are working in certain things that I don't know how to do, they have champions at other places. So I think that, COVID has given us the ability to virtually communicate. And I think that's good. So I think that you can have somebody that is, at Pittsburgh maybe, and help you in these regards as well. So no, I don't think you have to have that infrastructure. It's harder, but it's not impossible.
Thanks. But it's so crucial to have networks, whether you're a small institution or a large institution, and the leadership can provide those connections. So that I often found that was my role, to connect a young person with someone at another institution or another part of my own institution, so that they had the advice they needed.
I was just going to say, I'm on the membership committee for MSPDEC, and a lot of people there are in these smaller departments, and we often talk about partnering with bigger institutions, like you were saying. But I think as we within this group think about recruiting chairs to some of these smaller places, what advice do we have for the chairs who are going to some of these smaller places? How do you make those connections with bigger places? Because you guys were talking about the money, and it's not inexpensive, but yet these smaller departments probably don't have those types of resources even to pay the bigger institutions. So what does that look like? How do you help people make those connections when they're coming into a position that's a new role for them?
Let me just give you an example. So I do, vaccine work, and I also do surveillance work. So one possibility is to, as Arnie said, these networks can be really helpful. So if I'm starting a study or have a protocol, if I can sort of ask this new or get this new person from another place into my protocol, then I can give them a lot of the support from my infrastructure and how it works. So I think it's really through the networks. And then I think as those individuals have more studies and get more experience, and they can begin to establish their own kinds of things. Now, I don't know exactly certainly vaccine networks are in great trouble these days. But I think that some of the surveillance networks and some of the other groups within disease-oriented groups are a way to do this. And I think that's part of what we need to do is linking the young people to people that are more established, get them in there, and then allow them to kind of grow their own. And that's kind of what I did.
John, I would just add that I think that's the job of a chair. It absolutely is. And we need to do that at our chair meetings, and we need to work at that and know enough about the research that our young people are doing so that we can connect them to the right folk. Dr. Ruddy, do you have a comment?
Yeah, thanks, Arnie. I was just going to say, being an emergency physician and being involved with PCARN, having a network that's funded by HRSA, even though they don't fund a lot of the work, it's still all done by NHLBI, how important this is. But I'm going to use two words that are conflicting. It's at times it's how collaborative you are internally at the institution helps a lot versus competitive. And I know that's both helped, but also hindered sometimes how resources are allocated and how credit is sometimes given, and content experts are absolutely critical for even for all of us in a non-organ-based specialty, but it's, Catherine, I know I was on one of your DSMBs once. I know that the truth is we have to partner larger than our own institutions, too. We have to partner across the country. So I'll stop there. I could say more, but that's plenty.
I think one of the things that I have found so helpful in my work, particularly in surveillance, is the strengths of the emergency room. I could never have done this big, large CDC-funded pneumonia study without the emergency room. And so I, you know, the patients come in the emergency room, that's where they get enrolled. But then that also means that there's mentoring and acknowledgement of the emergency room physicians. And there's and there are the questions that are interesting to them. And so I think that's all part of how you make this better by really playing on the strengths that each individual group brings, but you also have to be very clear that the papers are shared and the honors are shared and the acknowledgments are shared with the people that are part of the groups.
I would agree, and I want to comment about this because, again, I think it's the chair's responsibility to make sure that this happens. How does a chair facilitate the collaborative nature and the sharing of the honors that come along with quality work? And that depends upon all of us as leaders, the division director as well. The attitude and then the recognition, I think, are really important to create the environment, the people environment that facilitates research. And I think we all know that, but we don't always do it. And doing it publicly, in front of the whole faculty or in front of the whole institution, I think is crucial.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30-plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com.